Welcome to the Chat TCG podcast. I am Paula Sabaga, financial advisor, and I am joined by John McCabe, also financial advisor. We are with TCG and Associates of UBS in Columbia, South Carolina, and we can be reached at 803-873-9850. Our guest today is C. Duncan Connolly, owner of 13th Colony Arts, LLC in Atlanta, Georgia. He is not affiliated with UBS Financial, and his views are his own. Good morning. Welcome to our podcast, Chat TCG.
We're very excited to be here today. This is John McCabe. That was Paula Sabaga. We are lucky enough to have C. Duncan Connolly, one of my best buds from over there in the 13th Colony. In fact, the name of his company is 13th Colony Art. He is a long-term, four-decade art dealer, I understand.
Yes.
He is here in Columbia on some business with one of our clients, and we're very thrilled to have you here. So we took this opportunity to pick your brain a little bit about the art world. To get us started, Duncan, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into the art business out of the University of Florida, out of Savannah?
Well, I came into it because my mother was a portrait painter in Savannah, and I got to know all the antique dealers in town, and people had old furniture and stuff. Mostly, they didn't buy it. They inherited it. And so I didn't know that there was really a market in it. And it wasn't really until I got out of college, University of Florida, with a couple of degrees in painting and art history, that I said, what the heck am I going to do with this? And I had a good friend that was in the auction business in Palm Beach, and I moved down after the last degree and worked with him there, and then moved to Atlanta to open up a gallery together with him.
That sounds exciting. So I didn't even know your mother was a portrait painter.
That's, yes, yeah.
Your father was in the investment business.
That's it. He worked at Merrill, yeah, for 37 years.
I know somebody that worked at Merrill for 30-plus years.
Me too.
Anyway, yeah, so here's I know you're in town now. A lot of our clients, what we've found, and a lot of people have done just what you were talking about, the inherited things, or they come across things. One of my favorite Shakespearean quotes, of course, is some people are born great, some achieve greatness, and some people have greatness thrust upon them. And in a lot of cases, I think a lot of our clients are having art thrust upon them that they don't know anything about. What's the market like for that? I mean, what do people do with art that they suddenly find themselves with?
The market is what I would call uneven, in that it just specific genres have their own markets. And American paintings of a particular period time, European paintings of Asian art, African art, Pacific Islander art. It just goes on and on. Canadian paintings, Mexican paintings, Central America, South America. Everything is specific. And the thing to do if you do inherit things or if you bought things over the years, if your children don't want it and you want to dissolve it, the thing to do is to find somebody who knows quite a bit about that and pursue it, who's actually not a scholar necessarily in it, but somebody who actually deals in it.
And so you act as oftentimes, I'm sure, as a mediator between some of the big houses like Sotheby's or things like that. Is that when people want to either buy or sell, is that what you're doing?
Well, I would only recommend things to go to auction when they would have the best performance at auction. Some things are better sold privately. Some things are sold through a dealer that would be advertise it and show it off, that sort of things. Other times people want to not talk much about it and sort of keep it low-key and don't know that it's for sale. And so depending upon what the customer wants is the path that you would take.
How do you view art? You know, we're in the investment world, and I mentioned this too, I think, on the phone yesterday. So when we buy and sell stuff, we're used to doing it on a keyboard,
right,
with one stroke of a key, and we buy it and we sell it. I would assume the high-end art world and antique world is a different world. How do you see the markets right now? I mean, do you see them as who's buying this? Who's selling it?
Well, that's a good question. And the things that I deal in, which are 19th and early 20th century American and European painting and sculpture, the people tend to be, you know, 50 and above, because the people below that age are looking at more of contemporary works of art. They have more interest in that sort of thing. I mean, I love it too, some of it. Some of it I can't think about living with, because it's it's too challenging. in terms of the subject matter or the way that it's made and presented. Being an old person, I really admire beauty.
Well, I've been to your house in Buckhead, and believe me, there's a lot of beauty there, and I couldn't see an abstract fitting into your house anywhere.
Well, I love abstract, if it's good.
So let's talk a little bit about authenticity. So I know one of the things we're going to do today as we meet with our clients and I introduce you to them is that there's a question about certain paintings or as to whether they're real or not. We had that situation. I think we were talking about a Picasso.
Mm-hmm.
Can you go into that a little bit about how you authenticate things?
I can, and that, of course, Picasso is the most complex human being on earth when it comes to that. Because there is an established family members that are still in Paris, and things have to go through them to get a letter to say that it's authentic and that sort of thing. And mostly it's a way to extort money from people who bought these paintings, you know, decades ago, probably. There are laws in France and, of course, all across Europe that if the people who have the authority to deem something to be authentic or not, they can also take that painting from you and destroy it. So it's a little bit more complex. You know, we just like say, oh, thank you. I'm sorry, it's not real. Okay, fine, I'll go about my way.
Throw it in the trash heap in the backyard.
They don't do that. They don't do that because it affects the oeuvre of the artist's work.
Now, that would make perfect sense. If someone wants to invest in some of the painting and sculpture, and especially here in the Southeast, because a lot of our clientele are here in the Southeast, I'm sure Atlanta has got to be the hotbed for the artwork. You're there. I mean, the High Museum's there, all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
What do people in the Southeast, what are they looking for if they wanted to invest, if they wanted to buy? What artists or what types of paintings are they doing? Landscapes are they doing? What are they doing?
Well, it varies. And of course, when you mentioned the museums want to be very up to date compared to what's in California and New York and Chicago and all that sort of stuff and Europe. So they are looking at more contemporary works of late, 20th century works of art and things that were made 6 months ago. So that's a completely different market. And money chases these things that I believe that in the near term, I'd say in the next 10 years, these things may be just thrown out into the street. Some of it is so psychosexual or complex to the extent that it challenges you in a way that's physical through visual. Looking at a painting and just go, wow, that's challenging me to a fight. I mean, but you got to remember that, you know, desirability of what I've always collected has been 19th and early 20th century art.
Yeah.
You need to find some. If you have that sort of thing and you want to get in that game, I would not be the person that you would consult, but I could find the person for you to consult.
That's exactly what our clients would want. That's perfect. Let's talk a little bit about your sculpture. You know what a big fan of sculpture I am. I think you have what you used to have. I don't know if you still have it. Just the Francis Marion Maquette.
Yes.
When we traveled to D.C. to talk to the thundering mean people up there in Washington trying to get our Francis Marion Memorial. But what's the market for sculpture? Three-dimensional art has always intrigued me much more than two-dimensional art.
Well, it's interesting. Most people don't live with sculpture. They always grew up with portraits of family members or landscapes or, you know, marine pictures, something like that. You know, if you're up at Cape Cod, you got something up there that shows the region. Same thing in the American South or California. You know, all these – Hawaii even has its own genre. And Alaska as well. And I think that sculpture is something that is an afterthought to a lot of people. I love it.
Daddy too.
Particularly if it's not site specific. In other words, it's meant to be looked at one side only, like it goes against the wall or something. But the three-dimensional is a figurative or animalier sculpture, dogs and foxes and fish and all that sort of stuff. I love it.
We were recently in Greece, and our tour guide took us to the place where the farmer found the Venus de Milo in 1830. And I think he says, well, we've already got we already got a couple of sculptures. You can have this one, France, if you want it. So they took it with them to the Louvre. That was my favorite thing about our trip to Greece. You've got the book in your hand, and I want you to talk about that book.
Well, I'll talk briefly about it. And this is a book. He's written two really wonderful ones. His name is Gerald Rietlinger, That's R-E-I-T-L-I-N-G-E-R. And he's a British fellow, and he writes beautifully. And he wrote in the 50s about something called The Economics of Taste. Hmm. And it's a study of the rise and fall of objects of art in the market since 1750. Now, this was written in the 1950, so 200 years about. And of course, in Europe, and since he's in Great Britain, he's closer to Europe. And think about all the wars over the last 200 years in Europe. Hmm. I mean, what'd they do with all that stuff? How much of it was destroyed? So he talks about the economic changes that go on in a country or a region over time. And it's not uncommon in times of struggle, you know, you can buy old master paintings for nothing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, once everything's beautiful, and all these people jump into it. It's a study of something that's been going on for a long, long time. So this is not a new thing, trying to figure out what the heck the market is.
Yeah, I was wondering. So, and that was written in the 50s. So that was 70 years ago. So what do you see in your practice? Has his premise kind of continued, the rise and fall? I mean, we haven't had a lot of storming of the Bastille or, you know,
well, we haven't,
Nazi
but
seizures.
It's a matter of time. It's coming. But of course, you just take his title to heart, The Rise and Fall of the Picture Market, because it's going to rise and it's going to fall. And the best thing to do if you like paintings or sculpture or art of any sort, buy it because you love it. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't study about it and know about it, know who the other the artists or sculptors that he worked with at the same time, if there was some sort of movement associated with it, with a coalesce of thoughts about what is significant for that kind of art. It's always going to change. It's always so. There's no answer to your question.
I think that's the real, real good advice for our clients, and I say that because art is not like buying, you know, 200 shares of NVIDIA or something like that. The beauty, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. And so if you're buying art, it seems to me either wall hanging art or sculpture or whatever you're doing, the first place has got to be in your eye. And the second place has got to be in your heart.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't you think?
It's wonderful to fall in love with something. I mean, I've done my share of falling in love. I didn't get married until I was 37. I did a lot of interviewing, but finally I made the sale. You know what I'm saying?
I'm about to say you closed the deal there, Duncan.
And happily so.
Yes.
Falling in love with paintings or types of paintings, sculpture, or anything else. Oriental rugs, American 1950s furniture, whatever it might be that turns you on. It's good to have a library. Now, I know that's not in favor these days. Mm-hmm. You know, I watch people at antique shows, they buy books because they have leather bindings.
Yeah.
Without any desire to know what's in between the boards of those books. So I know people have libraries, but you should really have a library to study these things and to know it. Everything's not on the internet.
As a long-lost English major, I fully agree. I fully agree. I like to know what's in between the boards.
So I have one question. Do we buy low, sell high when it comes to art?
If you can, the clever people will look at a market and go, boy, it's hot, and things are going fantastic. And that love thing, you need to break up. You need to let it go. If you don't want it, because at the end of your life, it may be in a down cycle. Mm-hmm. Or like I found with my own children, I used to collect 18th century Virginia and North Carolina furniture, fabulous stuff. And they're sort of frontierish as opposed to New York and Maine and Connecticut and Philadelphia, that very high style, English influenced,
sure.
18th century furniture. And I used to buy it and put it in my attic for my son. I have twins, a boy and a girl. Before my son got married this last year, I took him up in the attic and I said, son, I've got some great stuff. You're going to love this. Unbelievable. And he looks at it and he goes, my God, it's all walnut and mahogany and it's so heavy. How are we going to get it out of here? He just did not get it.
Was he already writing out price tags on it?
Well, he likes to think, what can I get for it if he should die tomorrow? But which unfortunately is less than what I paid for. But living with things that are spectacular and wonderful and something to be appreciated, is something that material culture is important to living.
Yeah, I fully agree. Paula, talking about buying low and selling high, let's end our conversation or move towards the end of our conversation. We had talked about, I remember when I had first met you about 15 or 20 years ago, there was a time when you were said, the art market is dead and I'm selling everything and I'm going to become a fry cook or something. I don't remember what you said.
Couldn't get a job. So I stuck with it.
So tell, was that during the banking crisis? I can't
remember. Yeah, that was 2008, 10. Yeah, I was about to jump off the wall. 29's got nothing on me. I mean, I jumped off the ledge.
1929. Yeah, that's what I've got.
That's about when they used to have auction estimates of 30,000 to 90,000. Yep. That's kind of a range, isn't it? Because the auction houses didn't know the value of anything because they didn't have it.
It's kind of like they couldn't get a bid on it.
Right.
They couldn't figure out where to start.
Yeah, and it was a horrible time.
But like, so what brought the art community out of that?
Well, people got rational and said, look, we want to honor these things by this oeuvre, this work of certain artists, and other ones we're going to leave behind. And it always happens. In war or economic downfall, certain artists rise above after it, and some are left behind.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that's unusual.
I mean, when you talk about that, I just think about all the what was that movie with George Clooney and the guys went in looking for all the Nazi art, the stolen art.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and all that stuff. I mean, that was some interesting stuff. The Lady in Gold, I think, was a really good movie with Helen Mirren.
Right.
And about a lot of that stuff. Paula, do you have anything?
Can you share a story where one of your clients discovered they had a piece that they might have thought was not valuable and it ended up being valuable or something different?
Well, I usually have it in the opposite thing, that they think it's worth a fortune and it's not. But it does happen. And it's not so much that my clients have had that experience, because they want to keep it from me because they don't want me to bid, you know, to go after it. So they don't tell me about it. And I do the same to them because I find things that people, oh, I've got this painting that my grandmother gave me and it's a wonderful thing and you should go. Oh, my God. I said, I'm thinking, well, I'm coming right down to the Morris Museum in Augusta, the Southern Museum, and I'm going to sell this guy. Take me 15 minutes to sell this thing. Those things do happen. But it really doesn't happen as much as you wish that it would.
Right.
I would think it would be a lot more of the, I think I've got a, you know, millionaire masterpiece that's really just a copy.
Yeah. My grandmother always told me it was an Audubon. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a reproduction of an Audubon or something, you know, that's a more common thing.
Yeah.
Right. So do you go to different estate sales or heck the Goodwill and for people throwing things away that end up valuable?
I used to when I was younger. And I still do it a little bit now, and I certainly go to antique shows, and I keep in touch with a lot of dealers, because dealers are really, if you think about it, the guys that sell things to museums, guys and gals who sell things to museums, they are the ones that are out shaking the leaves in the hinterlands, and they find things, and they're the ones that bring it to the museums. And also, much of the intellectual commentary about those artists and about those specific works is always written by a dealer trying to sell it.
Yeah,
he has to have the information that's going to excite the guy that knows what he's looking at.
And I think that goes back to what my mother always told me, is that you got to consider the source in anything you hear. You got to know where somebody's coming from. I think that's going to wrap us up, Duncan and Paula. I think that I'm going to walk Duncan down the street to the Columbia Museum of Art for a minute or two and show off Columbia's best-kept secret.
I sold a few. Sal Salillo was the director of it at that time.
It was a while
remember
ago.
Him?
I don't
it's remember. Been 25 years ago.
Man. Paula, do you want any closing thoughts?
Well, if any of our guests have a need to call you or reach out to you, how would we find you? Is online the best way?
Oh, I have a Hollywood agent, of course. You could call me in Atlanta. The name of the company is 13th Colony Arts, all written out.
Thanks.
I'm old. Better get to me soon.
Oh, no. So just, yeah, well, you were just in Stuart, Florida, buying a boat and trading surfboards. So
my wife didn't know a thing about this, well, and there you go.
I will not send her this podcast.
Well, thank you, Duncan, so much for sharing your experience. And John, thank you for bringing him in.
Life is too short not to do
interesting things. Well, my great pleasure. Love to do it.
Yes.
Absolutely. And thank you for being here. Thanks for the drive over this morning. You're perky after a 3-hour drive.
Thank you.
Thank you, Duncan.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.